everyone, and welcome to Filmstrips, the podcast that will one day possibly be taken over by our immediate children. I'm Dave Babbitt.
And I'm Andrew Kanegeiser, excited to party like it's 1997. Dave, who are we and what are we doing with everyone's time this episode?
Why, this is Filmstrips, the podcast in which each and every week we take a look at a film, we look at the nuance, the subtext, the paratext, spoil the ever-loving hell out of it. The important thing is that each and every film under discussion must somehow connect back to the preceding episode, which we discussed on the previous, well, I botched that, but point of matter is, previous film we discussed on last week's episode. We're professionals here. Andrew, what were we taking a look at last time on this little program of ours?
Now, if we looked at the preceding film on the previous episode, we talked 2 weeks back? No, last week, you and I were joined by our good friend and beloved frequent guest, James Rivnak, to take a look at the singular and inimitable, and probably for the best possible reasons, the 1990 film Heart Condition, which proves that racial animus can always be overcome by transactional friendships predicated on immediate need. From that, we decided to follow Chloe Webb, who I think we can all agree maybe had too small and too thin of a role in that film. We decided to follow her to something else. No, not Sid and Nancy, which Andrew was hoping for. Instead, we decided to follow her to 1997's She's So Lovely, directed by Nick Cassavetes. Yes, John Jr., except his name is Nick. Featuring a script originally written by John Cassavetes, and a cast featuring, in addition to Ms. Webb, Robin Wright. At this point, I think she was Robin Wright Penn, Sean Penn, John Travolta, James Gandolfini, Debbie Mazar, and Gina Rowlands, because of course, and Harry Dean Stanton.
Yeah, indeed. Although we should probably be able to say for Chloe Webb, we've followed her from a very thin and small role in one film to an even thinner and smaller role in an even later film.
As I was telling Dave before we started recording, I genuinely do not know the character she played in this movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's interesting because we have looked at John Cassavetes before. Definitely not, I think, what you would call a typical Cassavetes film. We're going all the way back to season one for Machine Gun McCain.
Yep, and then we later took a look at him as part of The Killers. Yes, that Don Siegel film where...
Oh, right! Yeah, that one. Yeah. With the amazing map.
Indeed, the amazing map and those wonderful rear-view projection shots with go-karts. Life was fun.
I mean, there's also plenty of people who might know John Cassavetes from, say, The Husband in Rosemary's Baby, the guy who explodes at the end of Brian De Palma's The Fury, spoiler alert, or just as someone who gets name-dropped in that song by Lateague. But I think, as we've probably talked about before, though, John Cassavetes is a very interesting figure, like Dennis Hopper, where despite maybe being more famous as an actor, there's a certain section of film nerds that probably hold him up higher for his contributions to American independent filmmaking and his work as a director.
Yeah, and I think arguably I would say he's probably more famous for that even than his acting at this point. I don't think too many people will... that's not to say he was a bad actor, far from it, but I don't think in the popular consciousness his work as an actor outside of the films he made as a director have really been remembered by the public at large. He's a
very Criterion Collection kind of filmmaker.
Yeah, he's a cinephile.
Dave, I would say one important counterpoint to the idea that his acting career took a backseat. His appearance in Columbo Season 2, Etude in Black.
Yes, let's not forget, his frequent collaborator on a lot of the movies that Cassavetes made was Mr. Peter Falk as well, so...
Yeah, sadly not appearing in this film. I think he was tied up with ABC's run of Columbo Goes to the Supermarket, or whatever was airing this time. But I mean, before we talk about John Cassavetes, his life and his work, we should probably square up with maybe the least popular film that his son has made. And that is probably the perfect opportunity for Dave to do what he does best and give us the rundown.
She's So Lovely is the 1997 film romance from director Nick Cassavetes. Written by the late John Cassavetes, the film is the story of Mo and Eddie, a dysfunctional married couple whose relationship is disrupted when Eddie is institutionalized. 10 years on, Mo finds herself torn by her love for Eddie and the family she started with her new husband. Despite a high-profile cast including Robin Wright, Sean Penn, and John Travolta, the film was met with divisive reviews and mediocre box office, with no real critical reevaluation having happened in the past 24 years. Coming up after film strips, John Hurt curses his agent when he makes a guest appearance on Friday the 13th, the series.
All right, so as the song says, what's your take on Cassavetes? I'm not going to drop that song lyric any more than I absolutely need to.
Fair.
But I guess maybe seeing as we have a script that is credited to John Cassavetes, though I believe with rewrites from his son Nick,
yeah.
Kind of important this time to focus on Cassavetes as a director. Now, granted, I haven't seen, I would even say, a lot of the films that he wrote and directed, but I have seen some of the significant ones. Maybe the starting point, 1959, which seems like forever ago because it was. He ends up writing and directing the film Shadows. Now, Dave, have you ever seen that?
I have not seen Shadows. Cassavetes, a lot of his filmography is a bit of a blind spot for me. I really do need to get caught up on some of it. So naturally, we chose this film as a way to get into him.
Exactly. I haven't seen Shadows in quite some time, but it's made in 1959. It's set in New York, and it not only is it an independent American film made at a time where that doesn't really happen, aside from like weirdos road showing their films like Reefer Madness and things like that, but you know, Cassavetes as a director kind of establishes sort of a more workshop approach to scripting his films. A lot of it is shot on location, a minimal budget. It also draws very heavily on neorealism and sort of the idea of social realism as well. And I think the thing that most people remember is that it's a film made in 1959 about interracial relationships, at a time where, like, mainstream Hollywood simply was not touching the subject. But, I mean, it ends up not being, certainly not a smash, but as we nodded to before the break, it was a film that did really well in critical circles. People debate the level that it was influential on the industry as a whole, but, you know, Cassavetes ends up steadily writing and directing his own projects every couple years. So every 2 or 3 years, he seems to drop something that's largely financed by his appearances in more mainstream fare. Some of the more famous ones, A Woman Under the Influence, Killing of a Chinese Bookie, Opening Night, and in 1980, Gloria. And that one ends up coming full circle because Columbia Pictures releases it. But, without having seen them all, my understanding is that a lot of his films are very much kind of a combination of neorealism and French New Wave, where they're not necessarily about anything as much as the dynamics between characters and the internal dynamics of the characters themselves.
Well, yeah, and that's the big thing. From the ones I have seen, his focus is very much character over plot. There's not usually a clear, you know, this event happens and then the whole story spirals from there and then it has to meet until it reaches this resolution in a clearly defined way like you might think in a mainstream Hollywood film or a lot of conventional storytelling. It's much messier, it's much more open, and a lot of the joy comes from watching the actors perform and sort of live in these characters as we go through, as we follow them.
Yeah, there's something that feels very like NYC off-Broadway theater in the approach. like, you know, that heavy reliance on almost like the Stanislavski method of inhabiting your character.
Well, yeah.
And it's also like French New Wave kind of comes to mind, only that certain films of his, you know, are maybe more sort of high concept in terms of plot than others. But even at the best of times, like, plot really is there to just be the framework, like this sort of nucleus that the rest of the film just sort of meditates around.
Yeah, and that's sort of the key thing here. So, I mean, even as we'll get into with this film where, yeah, John didn't get to see it through till its end for obvious reasons, he died. The point being here that...
Spoilers!
Yeah, the point being here that, yeah, I mean, even this film, while I would say is arguably more structured than the other films I have seen, it still is very close to that sort of Cassavetes sort of looseness that where, yeah, it really isn't about the plot itself. Because really, when we, particularly when we get to this film, we can describe the overall plot in just a few sentences and we'll be done very easily. Like, it's not about the plot of this film.
Which is, you wouldn't necessarily think that given all the marketing materials of it, or the fact that it certainly is presented as if, like, it's your standard 1997 romantic comedy in a lot of ways, even down to the poster. But I guess the operative parts here is that Cassavetes, well, as you said, died on the way back to his home planet. He dies in 1989, and leaving behind his spouse, Gina Rowlands, he also leaves behind a son, Nick, who... I'm trying to see if Nick Cassavetes had directed any other films prior.
He does direct one film prior to this film, which was Unhook the Stars. At least that's the only one that's credited to that. But Nick Cassavetes is actually a working actor who gets a start in the 1980s in this part.
Yes, he also played Charlie in Delta Force 3, The Killing Game.
Indeed. And the thing is, yeah, what ultimately happens is with this project, this was actually She's So Lovely, which was originally known as She's Da Lovely, named after the Cole Porter song, was actually something John Cassavetes was trying to make in the 1980s, and he was trying to do it with Sean Penn back at that time. And apparently, from the sounds of it, Penn and him just couldn't fully agree on sort of an approach, an idea about how things were going to work. And again, this is very young, very temperamental Sean Penn. See his legal history, folks. Point.
Not that young. This is a couple years after the SWAT team had to get called in to break up a fight between him and then lover Madonna.
Like I said, look at the legal history. But yes.
Now I have seen it noted that one of the reasons why Cassavetes Sr. and Penn couldn't agree is that Penn was insistent, actually, that Madonna end up playing the role of Mo in this film.
Yeah.
Which is doubly ironic, because by the time the film gets made, the role of Mo is played by Sean Penn's current partner.
Yeah, then current partner. Not his current partner, let's be clear about that. We'll get back to that. But yeah, I mean, effectively, yeah, John doesn't get to see this film through, and ultimately he passes away. But his son Nick does apparently eventually sort of galvanize the idea of, I want to get this thing made, I want to get it through. And one of the things that's important here to keep in mind is that we are very much in the midst, as we've previously discussed on the show, the sort of Miramax Hollywood indie phase. This was indeed a film released by Miramax in North America. And though, if you look at the producers on this, Rene Clément, who is a French producer, is working on this one. So from my understanding is there was a ton of French money actually put into this film as well in order to get it made. And yeah, from everything I can see, effectively Nick wanted to almost treat this like a tribute to his dad. Like, you know, I'm going to complete one of the uncompleted projects for that. Having said that, here's the thing we need to note about Nick Cassavetes. It's always, we've talked about people who've had famous parents and then descendants who work in the same industry and how they can end up being very different individuals from one another. Let's, for example, Robert Downey Sr. and Robert Downey Jr. You know, their father and son, very different careers between the two of them, and very different types of films they made. And in the case here, I mean, Nick Cassavetes, I mean, he gets his start as an actor, but when you look at the body of work he did as an actor, you know, I would say he was generally a much more mainstream actor. And then when you start looking at his credits as a director after She's So Lovely, there is no mistaking the fact that he is making movies his dad probably never would have been involved with as a director or writer in any way.
Well, Cassavetes may have made John Q, but it would probably have a very different focus.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're right. Because let's see, 2002, he makes John Q. 2006, he makes Alpha Dog, which I think is in some ways an underrated movie. It's certainly closer to the Cassavetes family crest, but it also has a distinctively different kind of formal register to it. My Sister's Keeper, Yellow, The Other Woman, and the big one, 2004's The Notebook.
Yeah.
Which I would like to point out, directed by Cassavetes and featuring a small role by James Garner, which means it's the missing link between Columbo and the Rockford Files.
There we go. But yeah, I mean, Nick Cassavetes is much, much closer to the Hollywood system. At one point in time, he was attached to a version of an Iron Man film being developed at New Line Cinema before Marvel got the rights back and launched their whole studio with that one. I mean, Nick is very much a Hollywood player. But at this stage of the career we're looking at this point with She's So Lovely, this is Nick finding his voice and really kickstarting his career. So, I mean, I think that's worth keeping in mind here for a couple of reasons. Because number one, if you're making a film that's almost a tribute to his dad, I don't think it's unreasonable to expect that he's trying to sort of emulate his father in certain respects. But it's not going to be a perfect emulation. It's going to be, you know, Nick's still going to have, you know, the fact that he is a different filmmaker than his dad show up. And likewise, he's making this in a very different era with a very different group of people than his father would have
made. And one thing I wasn't able to pin down, but I was trying to find out approximately when John would have written the script for this movie, because presumably the film takes place in or around present day. Everything about this film feels much older.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, it's hard to really get a bead on the time. I mean, you can make some guesses, but yeah, I would say from this film would have at least had to have been written, I'd imagine, by around 85, 86 at the latest there, which means that given the time frame of this film, probably sections of it would have originally been set in the late 1970s, certainly, and then with the contemporary stuff being set in like 86, 87, 88, somewhere in there, depending upon when the film itself was released.
Well, yeah, just thinking about it, though, it becomes an interesting, sort of interesting critical companion to Gus Van Sant's Psycho, right?
Yeah.
Which, famously, it tries to be as faithfully close to a shot-for-shot remake of Hitchcock's original. This is, instead, it feels very much like trying to make the film John Cassavetes would have made as closely as possible, you know, a generation and 15 or so years removed. But yeah, I mean, I guess that takes us to the film itself, though. Because, again, the reason why we're foregrounding so much that this really isn't the plot-driven film that you think it is, you're right, I think you can sum it up pretty simply. It's the story about Maureen and Eddie, who are a couple. Their lives are very chaotic. A series of circumstances causes Eddie to be institutionalized, and when he's released 10 years later, he discovers that Maureen has a new husband and a family.
Yeah, now, I want to pause before we get into the film super quick here, because I remember the marketing campaign around this film so much, because, again, in keeping with the way this was clearly not being made and released like a John Cassavetes film would have been in the decades prior, I mean, this is a Miramax release. So part of that means it's got a bunch of big Hollywood stars in a role, unlike the Cassavetes films where, yeah, John is, you know, a star of a certain stature. Peter Falk is a star of a certain stature. But they're not the ones that are going to be like big box office draws in this instance. Instead, We get a film here with, yes, Sean Penn, arguably at the height of his power at this point. His then wife, Robin Wright, credited here as Robin Wright Penn, who, again, very respected actor at this point in time. And in a key role that people might be shocked based upon his presence on the poster, how little he's actually in it, John Travolta at the height of post-Pulp Fiction success in this instance. And with that, I mean, the marketing campaign made this look like, you know, a drama and and the way they sold it was very much with that sort of halfway indie, but with that sort of hip Hollywood vibe to it. And the reason I say it, in part because if you saw any of the marketing materials for this film, the song Semi-Charmed Kinda Life is linked to this thing as hard as can be. Like, it was like the guitar riff, everything, like, it was all over the marketing for this film at that time.
Yeah, see, I purposely didn't watch the trailer, but I guessed that it would be footage of Meet Eddie. He's a little bit different. And then, you know, cut to Sean Penn shooting a paramedic.
See, and that's the thing. They treat it like it's a drama where it's like it's two men in love with the same woman and she's going to have to make a choice. And it's, you see a lot of, you know, John Travolta in his shouty acting from late in the film. You've got Penn where they sort of basically cut around the fact of what a, well, we'll get into what his character actually is like, but they really cut around the majority of it. So for all you know, it's just Sean Penn as romantic lead in this instance. And it's, I mean, again, when you hear the basic plot description of this movie, which is, yes, the way you think this film is going to play it is pretty straightforward.
Yeah, you think we're going to have 15 minutes of everything before, and then the rest of the film will be resolving this love triangle. And the actual balance is you get the first two-thirds of this film. It's only about 90 minutes. The first two-thirds are set up, and we only get the love triangle or any John Travolta in the final half hour.
Well, exactly. So, to get into this, okay, so we're not, I mean, we'll go scene by scene, but again, like, this isn't a plot-heavy movie. The important thing is, as the film opens...
with Bjork's It's Oh So Quiet on the soundtrack,
yeah,
which, again, great song, not something that John Cassavetes would probably use.
Well, no, and that's one of those things that already tips its hand to the sort of that 90s indie quirky style that is going to infuse this film there. And again, it's playing over these overhead helicopter shots of, I'm trying to think, is it Portland that they're in? Or, like,
No, it's New York, isn't it?
Is it New York? Maybe, like, it's not the...
It's New York.
Maybe I'm wrong, but it's not like your... It's not the usual shots of New York that you typically see where it's Manhattan Island or anything like that. No, this is a much more open sort of residential area, at least, that we're flowing over in this case. The important thing is regardless of where the film's set, we're basically opening up with Robin Wright playing Maureen Murphy Quinn, nicknamed Mo, as she'll be called throughout a lot of this film.
Update, it was filmed in Los Angeles. I don't think that helps.
No, it does not. But a lot of things are filmed in Los Angeles. Turns out it was actually set in Toronto. But we'll put that aside right now. Point is, we've got Mo here, and she's waking up in her apartment, and we quickly see she's looking around trying to find Eddie. She doesn't know where Eddie is. She can't find him. We don't even know who Eddie is. We can take some guesses. But she's sort of freaking out about this, loudly looking for him, and eventually going out into the hallway to start calling around to see if anybody's found him. And she has this very sort of tough-talking, really fast individual. It's like, I don't know where Eddie is. You know, he's been gone for 3 days. He doesn't, you know, I haven't seen him there. You know, he's taken off because I'm in the midst of being pregnant here and all these things. And she's just...
And you get the typical, like, irritated conversation with the police where it's like, how can you believe this? My husband's missing and they put me on hold.
Yeah, exactly. But while she's in the midst of this conversation, someone is walking up to her, basically to initially offer her a cigarette and then offer her some liquor. And this happens to be Kiefer, played by the late, great James Gandolfini in this instance, who, A, does not look like a Kiefer to me, but that's only because I only really know one Kiefer in this world. And that kind of skews things. But yeah, I mean, he's basically sort of, it's like, do you want a cigarette? No, of course I don't want a cigarette. And then sure enough, she takes the cigarette. You know, He offers her some whiskey. It's like, come on, I'm pregnant. I don't need the whiskey and all this. And it's like, I'm trying to find my husband. Have you seen Eddie? And he sort of comes across like the nice guy neighbor. Asking, it's like, why don't you have a drink? Why don't you come in? You know, things will be fine. And she's like, no, I don't need, I need to find Eddie. And the thing that's very quick.
Eddie's been missing for 3 days at that point. And I think that's a reasonable amount of time to be worried or to even think about moving on, right?
Well, yeah. And the big concern for her, she goes back into her apartment and we see her sort of chaotic, all that, you know, sort of chaotic, frustrating. And the thing is, we then very quickly see her go back to Kiefer's apartment door, knocking, trying, saying, hey, I'll have that drink. I'll come on in. And the one thing that becomes very clear about Maureen at this point is that she is indecisive or very, you know, of the moment whenever she's in it there. What is her, does she want, what does she not want? What decision does she want to make? What decision does she not make? This is going to be the pattern that we see sort of repeat throughout the rest of the movie where she really, what she wants seems to change moment by moment. At any point.
Which we'll certainly come back to because that kind of forms the, I guess, the climactic portion of the film. But yeah, at this point, though, she ends up going down to the bar and meets Shorty.
Yeah, so she heads down to the local bar and she's looking around trying to find Eddie because she figures he might be there. But there are two things. Yeah, first of all, she runs into Shorty, played by the great late Harry Dean Stanton, who, as ever, is incapable of turning in a bad performance. And also his maybe girlfriend. It's never 100% exactly clear what their relationship is. But Debbie Mazar as Georgie there. And Georgie, her view is just like, you gotta get over Eddie, he's not that good for you, he's giving a hard time.
Well, we also know this isn't the first time that Eddie's also just vanished on her before.
Exactly. And Harry Dean Stanton, as he's there, I mean, he's just got this sort of, God, everybody, can the world give me a break for 5 minutes look on his face at all times. Well,
you're a bunch of kids, all right? Come to your senses. He's not leaving you and you're not leaving him. Just be patient.
Exactly. And ultimately, though, who she spots is Kiefer's in the bar. And she decides that, yeah, I'm going to go and have a drink with him. Again, pregnant, looking to have this drink. You might have some questions about this, which Mraz and Stanton's characters are sort of looking at. It's like, I don't know about this, but...
Well, and I think we as the audience, the way that goes to the close framing of the two of them laughing, we know exactly where this is going.
Yeah, because after sort of like a smash montage of them drinking and dancing and everything else, they head back to the apartment. Basically, Kiefer's dragging her, you know, her in up the stairs as they're laughing.
She won't let him inside on the chance that Eddie comes back. So he asks her to come to his place. She resists, but then he points out, what, he's been gone for 3 days? You can't be out of the house for 10 minutes? But then you notice he gradually becomes less asking and more
aggressive.
Ordering. Which, again, you know, I was certainly fearing how well John Cassavetes, who himself has routinely been accused of misogyny in his films and his personal life, wondering how he would treat the scene that we can't ever forget from the VIPs. Thankfully, it goes a bit better than that, but it goes more or less as predicted. The two of them share laughs and drinks. They start dancing. Kiefer tries to kiss her. They get into a scuffle, and she ends up smashing a bottle over his head, and he gives her a couple good shots to the face before they basically call a stalemate, and she ends up leaving.
Well, and yeah, the way it's edited, it seems like there's a bit of gap time there, but it, like, I've heard some people describe that she is potentially sexually assaulted in this moment. There's not enough context clues that really point to that directly in this instance.
I mean, Kiefer clearly has designs to do that.
Yeah.
But, The operative part, though, is that she ends up leaving with a bruised lip and a couple new marks on her face. And here we go back to the bar, right? Because all of a sudden, Eddie is there.
Well, before she does that, she wanders down. She gets in her car. She drives down. And I believe, I can't tell if it's not quite a shelter. It's basically a sort of, I don't know whether it's a clinic or something, but she's basically saying Eddie's missing, everything's going on, and the worker that she's speaking to is basically treating it like, you know, did Eddie do this to you? As she looks at her face and is questioning her about this. She's like, no, I just want to find Eddie. I'm more concerned that Eddie might do something because he would think something happened to the other guy in this instance when nothing happened. And this is the sort of thing where she's asking for help, but it's very clear Mo doesn't really, she doesn't clearly know what she's looking for or wants in this instance. And sure enough, she eventually leaves. Her car breaks down on the way back. Of course it's raining. She eventually wanders in and finally walks it back into the bar where, in addition to Tony, Shorty, Russo, and Georgie being there, yeah, Eddie's back here in this instance. And Eddie, as we see here, he's got this, we should note here, first of all, Mo has blonde hair. This is important, trust me, later on. Eddie has sort of this almost like greaser's slick back hair that's like jet black here. It's a little hard to tell what he's trying to evoke. And, you know, he's like, Mo, you're here. And the thing that you might expect based on the way he looks and everything we've heard so far is that Eddie's maybe a tough guy criminal, right? He's the sort of guy who, you know, is likely to prone for violence, or maybe he's off living the life, like you might expect from sort of a standard film here. And what becomes very clear as this sequence of events plays over is that's not quite the case in this instance, at least not in the way we think, because, you know, I think we should just go ahead and say it. The thing that we'll very quickly realize about Eddie is that he is not exactly stable, to put it mildly.
And I mean, it kind of becomes clearer as it develops, but like one thing I found, he talks a lot, but I'm really like from frame one that he walks into the film, like I'm not entirely sure if any of it is meant to be sensible or logical or reasonable. Like, it comes off as sort of navel-gazing philosophy from, like, a hard luck sort of loser. But, like, the more and more I think about it, I'm like, very little of what he says actually makes rational sense. And that's kind of a problem, though, when so much of the film is trying to show us this character, but, like, the character themselves is not capable of meaningfully communicating with anyone in the film or with the audience watching it.
Well, here's the thing. I'm probably going to push back on this because I think there's a trick that the film is doing, and I think it mostly succeeds. But I think it's very important that when we get to the latter portion of the film to discuss that in the context to see how things work out. Because as it's basically watching here, we're getting sort of we brought up Sid and Nancy earlier for completely different reasons, but we have something that's not unlike Sid and Nancy in the sense that we're basically, what we're watching is two
toxic codependency.
Toxic codependency, but also immense completely dysfunctional human beings in some way, shape, or form, where the mood swings and passions that they go through are radical, and maybe you think it's the alcohol and the clear alcoholism that's going on. But as we will eventually see, that's not really the case in this instance. And sure enough, you know, it's not that he doesn't care for Mo. He does care for Mo. He has his way of showing it. But he's also very clearly not, it's wrapped up in a combination of toxic masculinity and possessiveness and the sort of insistence and Mo sort of passively going along with a lot of questionable things over this. Because eventually the way this night is going to play out, they get her changed, they go home, they decide they're going to go out there. Eddie takes her out to basically what's supposed to be like dancing at a club, where he eventually cons his way into getting the ticket operator there to pay their way in because he quote unquote forgot his ticket there. So again, you might still think at this point, oh, he's just a very criminal individual. He's just, you know, that's why he's a little maybe sketchy in certain ways. But, you know, after...
Or you might think that because he's played by 1990s Sean Penn.
Yeah, well, also very fair. But they get in, and again, we get a very nice little bit where we get a cover of the song Cole Porter's De Lovely as sung by Tito Lavera, his second time in the show after popping up in True Stories way back when, singing that excellent song Radiohead.
Yeah. Think of all the great actors we haven't seen, and we've had two different films with Tito Lavera.
Yeah, I'm always happy to see him. But yeah, I mean, it's a nice little sequence in that of them dancing to this, again, admittedly a lovely song. Still have no idea what De Lovely means at this point, but yeah,
it's like every Cole Porter song where it's like it's whimsical wordplay, and you know, 100 white people in Martha's Vineyard listen to it every year and say they don't make them like they used to.
Fair.
And that's about it. I think if you enjoy Cole Porter for music, you are probably going to get a lot more from this film than a contemporary viewer.
Probably. But the big thing is that, you know, he keeps, you know, number one, we get one moment, which is just weird, where after they leave, they decide they need to go get dinner. And they stop by this closed restaurant who they're banging. It turns out they know the owners. And I, for whatever reason, I don't know what Nick Cassavetes was necessarily doing. I don't know what connections were here. But in uncredited roles, we've got Talia Shire and Burt Young from Rocky appearing as...
I thought that was Burt Young because nobody else looks like Burt Young.
Burt Young is one of the most distinctive looking faces there. But it's just like Rocky reunion in the middle of this movie for one quick shot. Like, what is going on here at this moment? But yeah, they get, yeah, come on up, have dinner. And I thought this was going to be like, and there's going to be a whole scene with them talking. Nope. Does not happen. It's literally just Talia
Shire.
It
comes off more as like window dressing, almost like it's so on the nose where Nick is like, see everyone, I know my roots. I know where I came from. I know my Hollywood history.
Yeah, it's a little weird there, but hey, I'm hoping Bert and Talia got some paychecks out of this, and you know, Bert probably could use the money. But I say that, and I should probably shouldn't. He probably is, you know, wisely invested his funds over the years. Anyways.
I don't know. He was in Back to School, which is low-key one of Rodney Dangerfield's best films. Also featuring a performance by Robert Downey Jr. Everything comes together.
This was
before him and his dad saved Marvel.
But
So they end up going back, though, and then they have that encounter with Kiefer in the hallway where it's an exchange of looks, and then Mo flies off the handle to the point where Eddie knows that clearly something happened, and maybe she didn't fall down the stairs after all.
Well, but that's the thing. As it's played, it's like there's something about it. The point is Kiefer gets beaten up badly. They wander back into their apartment, and it sort of ends in this tender moment with Eddie talking about how he loves her and he's going to look after her and trust her. And then we cut to the next morning and Eddie is already anxious. He's like, I know you lied to me about something. You know, somebody did this to your face. Who did this to your face? Like, and that's where it's interesting because it's like he can't quite put the clues together in this instance. Yeah. Like there's something like would be obvious. In some cases, you would sit there and say, well, the character is just oblivious. This feels like a deliberate choice where Eddie legitimately seems incapable of rationally putting all the pieces together in a way that makes sense, but he's got a gun out. He seems sort of paranoid about this, shouting, demanding for this, and eventually leaves the apartment like he's going to go looking for Kiefer in this instance, which prompts Mo to call that the place that she went to earlier before Eddie turned up. And sure enough, two effectively orderlies or sort of ambulance attendants show up for what is essentially sort of a mental health check in this. But of course, Eddie's not there. And
yeah, so they tell Mo that, well, I mean, there's sort of that exchange where it's like, do you know where he is? And she says no. And then they just ask again and they're like, now, because you called us in, though, if we can't find him, we have to call the police. So are you sure he's not in there? But yeah, so she doesn't know. We then cut back to Eddie, who's theatrically drowning his sorrows with, what is it, the Siberian mist?
Yes, this made-up drink where he just wanders in there. It's basically got a little bit of everything in it. And sure enough, I mean, as the sequence is playing out, You're sitting here probably thinking that, you know, Kiefer's going to show up and something's going to go down and go wrong. But that's not quite what happens, because Eddie effectively starts ordering rounds of Siberian mists for everybody in the bar. And Mo eventually arrives with the ambulance attendants there at the bar. They're going in, to check on Eddie and talk to him. And Eddie's got the gun in his hand and he's in the midst of telling a story. And then he basically just spins around on the bar stool and shoots the ambulance attendant before that person can even get a word out at this point.
Now, I do wonder, do you think that's like a panic reflex, or is that a total accident?
And the thing is, I don't know. The film plays it very unclear as to, it could be either. And again, I do think it's a deliberate choice to leave it up to the audience to sort of make up their mind. I suspect, I mean, either way, the result is Eddie freaks out, runs
back. I think it's only worth asking, though, because, again, for a film that gives us so much on-screen character and so much dialogue, but so little insight into the characters, I think, given what follows next, I think deciding whether or not a character accidentally discharges a firearm and seriously wounds a paramedic, whether that's accidental or a deliberate choice, you know, I think that becomes more of an important question simply because there's so little to actually read the characters with. But I would agree that the film doesn't actually make it clear or neatly resolvable.
Well, it doesn't. I think part of the thing is that when it comes, the film keeps going on, what we realize about Eddie is I don't even think he is fully aware of what he's done. And that becomes the clear thing, because after taking a dive out the bar window and going on the run in the super dramatic moment with Mo trying to find him and chase him down, the police have been called, they're hunting down Eddie, he's still wandering around with a gun. It builds to eventually a scene where he wanders up to sort of a bus stop bench, starts talking about how hot it is with the gun in his hand. Somebody takes off. He decides he needs to cool down. So he literally takes off his pants so they're around his ankles and he's in his shorts in the middle of the day when the police show up and have him surrounded. And they're telling him, get it down, put the gun down. And Mo's there trying to, get to Eddie in this instance, but the whole thing's gone south completely at this point. And sure enough, Eddie is eventually taken down. He's not killed. He's not nothing like that, but he is taken into custody. And what we then cut to is back at the hospital, where they're basically explaining that Eddie is, he's shot somebody. The person isn't dead at this point, although at this point it's possible they still could die. Eddie's clearly not well, and the doctors have basically said, he needs help. And when Mo starts asking about, how long is that going to take? They're like, well, it could be a few months. It could be 3 years, or it could be 3 months. It could be take years. We don't know here. And I think based on everything at this point, it's super clear. Eddie is a disturbed individual in some way, or at least unstable in this instance. And when Mo goes in to speak with him for what may be the last time for a while, Eddie seems unresponsive at first, and it takes a fair bit of prompting with her pointing. It's like, in 3 months you'll be out, you'll get better, everything will be okay. And Eddie just looks like a lost kid at this point. I mean, the way Penn
plays
it.
He's also wearing a straight jacket and he's kind of in a cage.
He
doesn't quite fathom what's happening. His takeaway that we come back to is that he'll be home in 3 months. And this scene, I think it's a well-performed scene between the actors, even though I always think it's kind of weird watching, a married couple act romance on screen with each other. I'm thinking The Getaway.
Yeah.
It's like, we don't want to see your love life nearly as bad as you guys want to perform it on screen. I can also easily foresee this scene happening between Robin Wright Penn and Sean Penn, too. And again, the problem is, I think it's going for a tenderness that, especially in 2021, is kind of hard to see. Only because, I feel like this scene is designed to be look, underneath all the chaos, and underneath the fact that both of these people are clearly not able to manage their affairs right now, there is a bond, there is a love between them. Whereas watching it with my eyes, I'm just like, honestly, this is the best thing for everybody. You guys shouldn't be together, and Eddie clearly needs some psychiatric intervention.
Well, this is the thing about this film, and here's where, okay, there's the version of this film where what's about to happen is we're going to jump ahead 10 years, and the whole situation is completely flipped. And under normal circumstances, what the film would be is we cut back and Mo has moved on with her life and she's in a much better place. She's cleaned up her act. Everything's A-okay. And suddenly Eddie shows back up as this disruptive force that's threatening her newfound happiness in this instance in her family. There's a version, I think, that, again, I think the advertising campaign for this movie almost leads you to believe is what this movie would be.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I thought it's what this movie would be.
Yeah.
And it's not.
Well, no, because here's the thing, and this is where I think the two things we need to keep in mind that are important to this film is tone and perspective. Because I think the way the first 40-odd minutes of this film leading up to the break play out, we're basically like the audience looking in on this world of people who are too very clearly dysfunctional, do not have their stuff together, and are having to deal with some very serious mental health concerns. At the very least in the case of Eddie, if not possibly Mo herself as well. So we're sort of looking on, and it's almost like this tragedy where it's like, yes, you two love each other, but there are clearly some very serious issues that you both need to work out. And the thing would be, yes, in the conventional sense, this would be the tone that plays out through the rest of the movie. Instead, when we get into the second half of the film, I think for about 5 minutes, it lets you think that it's going to be the more conventional version of the story. And then instead, it flips the switch where we suddenly realize Mo's life may be, you know, technically more stable, but she has actually wandered into a universe where her newfound husband, played by John Travolta, Joey, is every bit as unstable and disturbed as Eddie is, but he just manages it in a way that's more to polite society in this way. And the film effectively becomes a farce at this point, where it's not a case of one, you know, the somebody who's slightly disturbed coming back into her life to disrupt her dysfunctional world. It's a dysfunctional individual coming into a still very dysfunctional space, one that just presents as being more stable than it is. And then we have to realize that the only sense of quote unquote perspective that anybody has on events is that which belongs to the audience itself. It's not within the universe of this film here.
Well, okay. Because I think the second half, we're probably going to argue a bit. And it seems that even most of the contemporaneous reviews I found at the time seem to anticipate that everyone's going to argue about the second half. I would agree with you that the second half is more farcical, but I don't think it rises to the level of capital F. Only because it feels like there are still too many moments where it goes for drama or goes for that, not melodrama, but sort of the social realism. Mostly the moments with the kids, I think. And, like, it does go for moments of severity that is very hard to square up when you also have, you know, Shorty showing back up and swiping booze from the house and Joey getting mad and pulling a gun on the family and, you know, the more bonkers elements. I guess my problem is that it's okay, we'll get through it and then we'll tear this film a new one. Long story short, in broad strokes though, yes, we do get the jump of 10 years later and we see a bunch of kids in a beautiful little home waking up. Daddy, who rolls over and we see that's not Sean Penn, that's John Travolta. And that's Joey, who is a bit rough, but certainly seems to love his kids. We see that Mo, now with long, dark hair, is now married. And she seems very nervous because she's expecting a phone call. And then at the same time, we also see Sean Penn with crazy long hair, because how else would we know that time has passed? We get a fairly lengthy scene of him basically having an interview prior to his release. And it's with a doctor. I'm looking at the name up now.
Yes, that
Dr. Green.
Yeah, Miss Green.
Who's here played by, yes, the one, the only, Nick Cassavetes' mother, Gina Rowlands.
Yeah, and it's a good scene where basically she's walking him through. It's like, okay, you know, you've made progress. You're taking your medication. You're, you know, being very, you're cooperative with your doctors. The only thing we seem, you seem to be really having trouble with right now is your sense of space and time right now, spatial recognition here, which will become an important factor and begs a lot of questions. And again, why I think this film is very much leaning into the comedy, because the way this scene plays out, we see her walking him through. It's like, what if your wife has divorced you and left you? How would you react to this? And,
well, because she also points out that Mo hasn't visited him at all. But also, there's an interesting detail where Eddie points out that, well, he's trying to choose his words carefully because he knows that whatever he says is going to determine whether or not they're going to let him out. And he wants to be out, but he doesn't know if that's actually what's the right thing to do here is.
Well, and that's the thing. I mean, the Eddie of this point is a much more self-aware individual. And I mean, yeah, he's more stable, but there's clearly, he's not altogether completely there either. And the thing is as the scene plays out, they notably cut off before he finally gives a response to the question that Green asks him about his wife and how he would react and whether, you know, if he feels he might give into a more violent impulse here. And because that's their big, big question. Then we cut back to Joey and Mo at their home with their kids, where Joey is kind of wondering, it's like, what is it that's going on? Why are you so sort of angsty in this point? And up to this point, Joey seems fairly like, you know, you're sort of traditionally, you know, sort of lovey-dovey suburban husband as he's presented here. And then when she notes that she's going to be getting a call from the hospital about Eddie here, he flips on a dime in this instance.
Yeah, but I think he's also right to do so, because as he points out, you know, it's like, why are you so worried about that? This is your life now. We have children together. We have a family. And Mo's reply, I'm sorry, but it just comes off as very insubstantial, where it's just, you knew when you married me that Eddie was the person I loved the most, and now he's back, and that's just how it is. And, like, I don't know. Like, again, I feel like a film like this probably would have gone over if it was made at the time Cassavetes wrote it.
See,
because, I mean, the idea of characters being impulsive and being insistent on weird mount, like molehills to die on, that I feel like it's more sensible in the context of a John film than a Nick one. And maybe it's the fact that it has too many trappings of then contemporary, like semi-independent film style to really fly. Like, it just, I don't know. And maybe it's also because I am a parent too. But I mean, like, it feels like, again, going back to sort of the farewell scene at the hospital, it's like, but what is this passion? What is this bond between Mo and Eddie actually based on?
But that, and I think this is the thing that's what I like about this, is that basically it is built on this, that sort of toxic codependency there. It is not a stable relationship, but it is one where, yeah, it is built on passion. And what the thing about it is, and here's the thing, because Joey's being played by John Travolta, and the way Travolta's playing it, and the way there's something clearly off about Joey himself. Like, he never comes across as, you know, a quote-unquote, you know, rational human being either, because his immediate thought is, that's it, I'm going to deal with him, I'm going to take it. He's talking about going to see a guy who's getting out of a mental health institution there, and I'm gonna go have my big mano-a-mano toxic masculine, you know, throwdown with him in this instance here. And that's
well, at least just letting him know you're not breaking up my family. Well, I think that's pretty understandable.
But the way in which he plays, and I think again, what throws me about it, why I keep thinking that again. You can't take Joey as an altogether stable or serious individual himself, is that every time they try and build him up as potentially, quote-unquote, the good father or something, they do something immediately after to undercut that deliberately. So, like, he goes and they finally offer, because one of the kids turns out to be, yes, in this case, Eddie's daughter, the one that Mo was pregnant with back 10 years previous, who's the oldest, and they ask her, do you want to go see your dad? You should go see your dad. Here, and she's like, well, I guess. They go to see it. We get what would normally be a tender moment where she, you know, where he explains, it's like, just so you know, I'm your dad. I love you. You know, I love you. And, you know, don't ever tell your sisters, but, you know, I love you most. You realize that. And it comes off as this sort of sweet, tender thing. Then we end up upstairs and the confrontation in Eddie's apartment with Joey, I think, is really what signals why we can't take Joey seriously. Because number one...
You're also forgetting, Dave, we get an extended, predictable, and deeply unfunny gag of Eddie getting a haircut.
I was going to say, leave that for the hits and pits section. We'll get in this case. Cause,
okay.
But yes, he does get
a... That haircut eats up a surprising amount of screen time.
And it's not just a haircut, but... you know, a hair dye job as well, because now Eddie has blonde hair. See, things have reversed. But the
yeah, it's like Bergman's persona.
But the big thing here is that when we get into this thing, like, Joey keeps, you know, this hyper-masculine, hyper-macho, you know, it's my family, I'm in charge, you stay away from Mo, you're not breaking up my family, all this. And there's Eddie, who's, like, cutting out little paper dolls for his daughter in this instance and is super slow to evolve and who clearly is still doesn't fully comprehend how the world has changed around him. He doesn't know what's going on here. And at no point does Joey pick together the obvious salute point here is that this guy is clearly not altogether in the room with me right now. Like, anybody during that situation should be able to put together, it's like, okay, you're unwell. We're just going to leave right now and we'll deal with you. Come back when you're maybe up for this conversation. He doesn't. Instead, he goes ahead and doubles down on the dumb toxic masculinity of number one, while he's yelling at his daughter to sit down and all this stuff, you know, after having this conversation about, you know, how much he loves her more. And we start realizing he's emotionally abusive towards his kids just as much as anybody else. He then turns around. It's like, you know what? We're going to hash this out tonight. I'm inviting you over for dinner. You can bring somebody. Like, no rational person would be making any of these decisions right now. And that's the thing where it's like, Joey, you know, he's not stable either. He's a different kind of unstable from Eddie, but he's just as unstable in many ways. He presents is more dignified and respectable, though, in this instance.
Well, no one's complete, but like we talked about last week, though, I think there is a harm, maybe even just a psychic harm to the viewer, in equivocating too much. Because it's one thing to be like, okay, Joey is certainly not perfect. He certainly has his character flaws. It's another to be like, he is exactly the same as Eddie, who disappeared, has a diagnosed mental illness, and shot a paramedic.
I'm not sitting there saying that it's a complete thing, but then again, let's look at the things that Joey will go on to do. Okay, he invites a guy that he knows isn't stable to his house deliberately for the
point. Because his wife won't talk to him unless he does.
But the...
Right? He knows that she basically can't function. She has all but said, look, if Eddie comes back, I'm leaving with him because I love him.
And she...
Sorry and thanks for the ride.
And she literally tells him, provided this, it's like, don't go see him. I'm not going to call him. I'm not going to have anything to do with him. I've married you. I'm staying with you. I'm just letting you know the way it is. And if Joey just stopped right there and did not go to see Eddie...
Yeah, but this is also a conversation where she says, sorry, but Eddie is the person that I love the most, and you knew that when you married me. And it's just, that's not to say anyone's right or wrong in this situation. All I know is that the final third of this film is watching three characters who are all unstable and pretty unpleasant, argue about affection. And at that point, I'm like, I'm not really concerned, I'm not really interested, and I'm not really invested in what happens to any of these people.
But this is where, to me, it plays increasingly like it is all going for big comedic swings and beats here, where we realize...
It does, but I don't think that that's an effective structure.
See?
I mean, if the film is going for the more comedic in the second half, it probably hits that mark, but that doesn't mean it's a good idea or an effective way to lay out a film, especially when the first half of it seems... Like, the first half of this film is angry philosophical monologues, watching a chaotic couple yell at each other and then profess their love, and then watching James Gandolfini try to sexually assault the lead actress. And then all of a sudden we're going to gravitate to sight gags about giving kids beer and how wacky it is when John Travolta gets mad. Like, that doesn't make sense to me, David.
See, well, but to me, I think that's part of what I sort of appreciate about this film is the fact that it's a film where we assume, we wander in assuming the universe makes sense, only for it to pull back and realize it doesn't. We're assuming that there is some sort of stable rationale that in which this universe makes sense. And we very quickly realize that, yeah, the world of this film doesn't. It's literally just, it doesn't matter where you are in this world. It doesn't matter whether you're in the suburbia with a family. It doesn't matter whether you're in this beat down apartment where alcoholism is rampant. Nobody in this universe is stable. There's no authoritative voice coming in to look into this.
Let me ask you a question.
Yes.
Have you seen Wall Street, Money Never Sleeps?
It's been a long time since I've come back to that one. But yes, I saw it years ago.
I saw it in theater and I haven't seen it since. But one thing I do remember because it irritated me so much is at the end, after everything Gordon has done, including stealing from his own children, he comes back and basically pays them back the money he stole and gives like this most half-assed speech. It's not even an apology, not even contrition. He's like, look, everyone's kind of a mixed bag, and that's enough to get forgiveness. And I'm like, I don't know. It's like to simply be like, look, everybody's a bit nuts. Hey, what a wild world we live in. That doesn't seem like an astute enough observation to really justify everything else that's happening in this film, or to really make it feel worthwhile.
See,
but I can already tell that this is going to become one of those episodes, so why don't we speed along and just power through the closing bit? Because really, the climax is the dinner party.
Yeah, so basically, Eddie does show up for the dinner party with Georgie and Shorty here. It's like
Georgie has to wait in the car.
Yeah, it's like, you know, Shorty doesn't even want to go. It's like, why do I got to go in? It's his dinner. It's like, come on, Georgie, be there for moral support. You know, it's like, you got to take in this.
They told me to bring somebody.
Yeah, exactly. They're telling. Bring in the booze. You can take in the, you know, you can't just show up and not bring something to a dinner like this. To which, you know, Eddie eventually freaks out. It's like, no, I gotta have a drink. Smashes the top of the liquor bottle and just starts guzzling it there before wandering in.
Yeah. And fun trivia fact, Penn did not realize the cameras were rolling at that point.
Who knows? But sure enough, they get invited in. And again, the way this scene plays, like the rest of this thing plays out, is like different shades of absurdity where, you know, yeah, you've been invited over to dinner. Joey is like on a hair trigger, eventually pulling out a gun, talking about this. He's demanding Mo get downstairs here, there to settle with this. We see, you know, basically Eddie gets to have a conversation with his daughter. And the thing about the kids, and this is partly why I don't think there's any way you can look at this as sort of a film about moral equivocation or that there's any moral to necessarily be taken away from this, is that the kids, as time goes on, are very clearly not connected to reality either, because when it comes to Eddie and Mo's daughter, she just seems ready to go. It's like, yeah, you should take mom and go in this. She's fully down with this. She's also, you know, drinking beer. Like, not just, you know, it's like, here, have a sip just to try it type thing. Like, no, Joey's like, have a beer, opens her up one, and just gives her the whole bottle as a 9-year-old in this instance. Again, responsible parent, very dubious here. And it does eventually build to Eddie discovering Mo basically attempting to commit suicide, though.
Which is, like, the most what kind of beat in the whole film. Like, he goes upstairs, finds her in the bathroom in the process of cutting her wrist. And it's like, but why is any of this happening? Other than the fact that people are crazy. Like, that doesn't seem enough. Like, because after a point, it ends up being things happen, the movie. And that's just not satisfying. But then we also get the scene of Eddie talking to his daughter, where basically she says, like, I want you, like, you're my dad. I want to get to know you. And he basically says words to the effect of, well, that's cool and all, but I don't want to be your dad. I'll be your second best friend, though. That's important. And it's like, the problem is, like, the way that it is staged and the way that that scene is scored and the way that scene is performed, that is definitely meant to be, like, a sweet, impactful moment. But when you step back, you realize, no, it's an insane father telling his child, like, I don't want you in my life.
I completely do disagree. I think it's played with irony full on display. Like, I don't think we're meant to take anything being said in this moment at face value. It is all...
Disagree.
Yeah,
All I know is that things come to a head, and then finally Eddie announces that, well, he's going to be leaving, but he's not leaving without Mo. And she basically kind of agrees, but is apologetic, to which Joey insists, okay, you can leave if you want to, but the kids are staying with me, which, thank God. And then they just get back in the car. There's a brief scuffle when Joey pulls a gun, and then him and Eddie get into a fist fight on the lawn. It's not as interesting as in Lethal Weapon. And knowing the film was originally called She's D-Lovely really explains this, because it culminates with, aha, title drop line of, she doesn't love you, she doesn't love me, pause, she's D-Lovely. Which, again, what does that even mean?
And, you know? And this is why I think the film is all meant to be kind of taking the Mickey out of these kind of self-serious, you know, relationship dramas. I do think that there's a degree to which this is
parody. What is the value in that, David? What is the value in doing so?
To me, it is literally in and of itself, that is the point. Taking the Mickey out of, the tropes, the conventions, the expectations we bring to these kinds of films. And basically...
So this film is the level of insight and critical shrewdness that, say, not another teen movie has. That takes the Mickey out of a lot of genre tropes. Look, let's argue once we're done with the plot. Yeah. Because literally all that happens after that is that they get back in the car, they start driving off, and as Shorty and Georgette are arguing with one another, Eddie and Mo smile at one another without saying anything, and the car drives off. And that's the movie.
Yeah, exactly. And
I feel like it's too plot-driven, or like it's too structured to go with that, like, Cleo from 5 to 7 kind of, like, slice-of-life abstractness. It's too purposeful to be, like, a meditative or philosophical film, but it's also too nonsensical to be a film with a clear plot or a clear point.
See?
And so it ends up being a film that's kind of about a handful of things, and as we've said with other works, like, it doesn't fully commit to them, but, like, this was a case where it really did feel like I'm watching 90 minutes of things just happening, and it's not ever clear what the point, what the purpose, what the significance of any of it is. And that's not to say that every film needs to be high art or needs to have a clear thesis, but I feel like given this film, like, if Nick Cassavetes in 1997 decides, I'm going to make a movie based on one of my father's scripts, clearly there's a reason for it other than just paying homage to your father's ghost. He saw a point in this. I don't see the point in it.
See, and to me, the whole film plays exactly. It's a film in which it is basically taking the sort of romantic triangle films apart. It is a film of people making empty statements and empty big gestures where they make statements that don't line up. Eddie's statement of she's the level he makes no more sense than anything he says during the first half of the film. But then again, within the confines of most romantic films of this sort here, where it's, you know, the combatants between two men over women, how often have we seen so many films offer absolutely empty, vapid, meaningless gestures and statements that are supposed to sound profound and add up to nothing? This whole film strikes me as deeply, deeply tongue-in-cheek and ironic about all of this. I don't think there's any way that we're meant to take what we're seeing on screen ultimately seriously. I think the first half of the thing is like setting up.
It means that the characters, you cannot have sympathy or pathos in a film that's completely saturated by irony. I will give you that the second half is more ironic, but the problem is that at the beginning, when we see a strung out Mo who's freaked out because she can't find her husband, when we see her get assaulted by her neighbor, those are not ironic scenes, Dave. And the problem is that once you decide that a film is ironic through and through, that becomes a convenient way to hand wave away things that may not be purposefully bad or nonsensical, but do so because they stumble in trying to do something good.
I won't make a claim that this is a perfect film. Do not get me wrong. There are problematic elements. I think you could easily ditch a good chunk of what happens with Kiefer earlier in this film, and it would be better for it. That is certainly the case. But I think there is this sort of sleight of hand that's being attempted here that I will give Nick Cassavetes credit for making the effort to try and pull it off, and I think he more or less does successfully compared to how badly it could have gone in this instance. And to me, again, I think everybody's playing at that same tonal level there where it rides the fine line until it finally, in the latter half, when it puts all its cards on the table, commits to finally playing it. It's like, and this is what the film really is. And to me, the structure works in its favor in that way there.
This film, though, would have been so much better and more, I think, easier to read if it is indeed a deconstruction of love triangle setups or anything of that nature. If they just, like, because when you use words like farce, I think about, like, shot in the dark, right?
Yeah.
I'm thinking, you know, where it's clear and manifest that we're in a heightened reality, that, you know, we are not meant to take anything seriously from frame one. And the problem is, you say the film is tonally consistent in that regard, and I disagree. I feel like it wavers between that sort of kitchen sink drama and then wanting to be wacky and whimsical. The same way that the film begins with the juxtaposition of Bjork's maybe most bombastic sort of big band type song, contrasting that to a dingy hallway and a woman who is on the verge of a breakdown.
See, and to me, it's walking a fine line tonally where it's being just arch enough in the first portion of the film that when the shift happens, it doesn't feel like a complete out of left field turn to me there. And that's the sort of the key to it here.
Navigating that pivot, Mulholland Drive shows you how to navigate a pivot between two radically different sections of a film. This is not that.
Don't get me wrong. I'm not going to make the claim that, you know, this is the masterpiece approach to having pulled it off. I think it's more successful than I would have anticipated in pulling it off. I think, you know, a large part of it is that, yeah, Nick Cassavetes is able to pull it off just enough. It's not perfect. It's not agreeable. And I certainly wouldn't compare him to what David Lynch does. David Lynch is on a whole nother level when it comes to that kind of writing of tones there.
And that's not a serious comparison. And I don't think you are seeing this film as perfect, but as I say, maybe every 75 or so episodes, I think your reading of this film is entirely too charitable, And while I don't ever want to tell you not to have as much good faith towards creators and artists as you often do, this is a case where I just do not see it, David.
Well, and I don't think that there's probably going to be anything much I can say to convince you otherwise. And I kind of
Exactly.
anticipated that.
Symbolically, you know, I'm a Joey, you are an Eddie, and this film is truly a Mo.
Okay, then. Oh,
I
so.
mean, I know that we're going to have a lot more to discuss, and I think hits and pits are going to be very interesting given how divergent our reactions to even talking about the film scene by scene have been.
Yeah.
Like, it's an interesting effort, but I think also adapting a Cassavetes script in the then present also really highlights. It highlights maybe both the time-locked nature of some of Cassavetes' films, but also how singular those films kind of are. Like, I feel like if anybody other than John Cassavetes was making, say, Killing of a Chinese Bookie, then it probably wouldn't have gone over so well, or maybe it would have seemed a little less unified than I think it's celebrated as. And I mean, by that same token, Dave, let's be honest with ourselves. Would anyone really have cared about this film at the time, aside from the fact that it was Nick Cassavetes making a film scripted by John Cassavetes? That's not to say it's the sole determinant of the film's value, but I think that is a big part in certainly the positive reviews I read in doing some research. They seemed really keen to foreground that fact. And I'm like, if this was just written by Nick Cassavetes on his own, I don't think it would have been as well received.
Well, and to that note, I don't think, yeah, I absolutely do not think you can divorce the reputation of John Cassavetes and how highly he's held in cinephile circles from the film itself here. I do agree. That probably did slant it here. That said, in terms of my own thing, I don't really have a strong opinion about John Cassavetes one way or the other. His work, yeah, doesn't really mean much of anything to me. And Nick Cassavetes, I'm generally not really a fan of for the most part. I think he's, I mean, as he's gone on, he's a talented, competent craftsman with the material, but I don't get excited at the idea of Nick Cassavetes jumping on and doing a movie. So, personally, my own enjoyment of this film, it kind of surprised me. I was expecting I was going to go in and not like it. And let me be clear about it as well. 9 times out of 10, Andrew, I would be fully on board with you in being a Joey Boaster in this case here. Like, I think, you know, on a surface level reading of it, yeah, I would completely buy it. Joey makes all the right moves in all the right cases. I just cannot square what we actually see between Travolta's performance and the tone and all the stuff, and with this being a, and we're meant to take Joey as a legitimately decent and healthy individual in any way, shape, or form. That's
It's not that he's healthy, it's just that he's healthier. I guess I'll leave you with two notes,
sure.
Maybe, and maybe for the listener to think about as well. Because one was Roger Ebert, his review at the time said, this film makes a lot more sense if you think about the script, you think about sort of the time delay between it being made, and you imagine the film where the three leads are being played by John Cassavetes, Gina Rowlands, and Peter Falk. To which I snarkily replied, okay, imagine it's a different and better movie. But another theme that's really come out in some of the critical takes is that this is not a film that asks us to judge or to criticize the sort of the validity of the character's decisions. This is a film that simply asks us to look upon it. I guess the final question I have for you is, do you think that's an absolute cop-out of an explanation? And if not, then where's the lie?
See, here's the thing. I think the idea of not having some sort of judgmental approach or some sort of response to it, I think is, well, you know, ridiculous. I think you are going to have a reaction to that. And I think, again, in any reasonable set of circumstances, you know, if this the reality of this film actually approached reality, you know, Eddie would never have gotten out of the institution because he's clearly not well.
Well, I think you hit on it right there, where the difference with, like, Italian neorealism or something like the Bicycle Thieves or what have you, the value in looking upon is to show the actual lived social reality of what it's like living in post-war Italy, right? Whereas here, you can't make that same claim because it says, we're just asking you to look upon this. This is not reality. This is not life as it is. This is, again, this is the opening family breakfast scene from Rob Zombie's Halloween dragged out for 90 minutes. And that's not to say every family dynamic is stable or even intact, but there's a world of difference between, you know, appraising this film as, no, we're simply meant to observe the modern condition. Like, some people have that approach. You have a take that's more, this is sort of ironic, farcical through and through. And I don't think both of those ideas can be held at the same time. And I'm willing to agree with you more than I'd agree with, say, A.O. Scott. And not just because, I'd rather host a show with you than A.O. Scott.
Well, same here. I agree. I mean, you can't, those aren't two things that you can hold in your mind at the same time. That said, this is a film, I think this is a film that obviously as it shown, it will prompt a lot of different reactions and a lot of different responses as to what you think this is. So on one hand, I say, you know, at the very least, it's a film that prompts a reaction. So, you know, good on it. There are some films that just sit there and don't do anything. But having said that as well, I mean, if you take the idea that this is observing some actual and is attempting to try and provide some sort of real nuanced insight into lived experience, then yeah, you can't divorce this from some sort of ethical or moral judgment going on. I just cannot square the movie that we actually see with anything resembling that. This is a case where it's like, and this is supposed to be, it resemble reality in any way, shape, or form. And if Nick Cassavetes turns around and says, well, no, that was actually what I was gunning for, then Nick, you failed. Let me be clear here. You absolutely,
your father
failed.
Is crying in heaven, Nick. Think about what you've done.
Yeah.
Just kidding. No way John Cassavetes went to heaven.
God.
Oh, God. Well, anyway. Speaking of the Infernal Pit, I guess that's the perfect segue to our patent-pending bumper segment, Hits And. I'm imagining most of the hits are going to come from you, David, so I will let you go first as we celebrate and condemn The Little Things. So, for 1997's She Is So Lovely, what is your first hit?
Harry Dean Stanton, because how can it not be Harry Dean Stanton? It's like, it does not matter where he shows up. He will put in all the effort, and he is always going to be a super charming presence. And yeah, I mean, Shorty as the best/worst best friend one person can have is just a delight, because he's closer to having some sort of sense of perspective on things. Close, but still not quite right as well. And Harry Dean Stanton walks that fine line superbly well. And even moments like his delivery of certain dialogue, like when Joey pulls out the gun and he's like, whoa, this isn't a gun. It's not that kind of evening. We just came for dinner. It's like,
he actually got me kind of howling with at the end when Mo, Eddie, and Shorty are about to leave. And Joey's like, fine, get out of here. You two pricks belong together. And Shorty is offended. He's like, are you calling me a prick? He says, no, I meant Mo. You calling your wife a prick?
Exactly. Like, just Harry Dean Stanton is an absolute joy. And he underplays magnificently in this film. So he has got to be my first hit for this one. What about you, Andrew? What would be your first hit, if any, for this film?
I would probably give my first hit to Robin Wright Penn. In some ways, this feels like a stereotypical big role or difficult role for an actress to play. But, I mean, Robin Wright, as time has gone on, has shown that she has a very capable range and she is a very strong performer. Like, this is one of those characters that could very easily lapse into self-parody from the outset. And while I don't really agree with a lot of choices that the film makes at the level of plotting, she does actually inhabit the character and gives a sense of reality or lived-inness to the Maureen character. And again, I feel like that is, if this film succeeds at all, it can only succeed by having that kind of performance. And by and large, I would say that Robin Wright Penn gives it here.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree with you on that. And on a related note, in a very different performance in a different register, Debbie Mazar, you know, her role is thin and not expertly, it's not the flashiest one here, but she's committed to her bit and she does it really, really well in this instance. I mean, she plays off of Harry Dean Stanton magnificently, whatever their relationship is at this point in time. And yeah, I mean, just even seeing, again, she's a nice comedic charm when she's like, so what, I'm just going to be sitting out here in the car the whole time? They're just like that exasperated frustration where it's like, well, yeah, I mean, that seems to be what's going on. I just love that at no point does anybody ask us, like, so we have another friend here. Could she come in for the dinner as well? Or just, you know, it's like, you know, give us 30 minutes and come back round. Like, nobody comes to that conclusion in this sense. But I like Mazar, and she's not an actor who honestly gets a lot of roles to shine in too often. So it's always, you got to give her a shout out when she has the opportunity here. So she definitely gets my second hit. What about you, Andrew? Is there a second one for you in this instance?
Oh, just trying to think here. Probably Gina Rowlands as Miss Green. It's a small role. She is probably the most realistic character in the film. But also, as we've said before, Gina Rowlands also is permanently on the hit list, if and only if because she survived a marriage to John Cassavetes. So it's always nice to see her work. You know, you definitely get the sense that this film was written with her in the role of Mo in mind. But it is a nice little nod to see that it truly is a family affair, I guess. Yeah, that's all I've got for hits. What's your second one?
That was my second one.
Okay.
We're on to Pitts now.
We may agree on more than we think. I'll hands down on the table. I'm going to go first. He won Best Actor at the 1997 Cannes Film Festival for this. Sean Penn as Eddie. I despised this performance.
Okay.
I really did not like him. And it's not because I'm predisposed to disliking Sean Penn, though I am. I mean, I liked him in Carlito's Way. Here, it's just, he's putting on a voice, and he's playing a character completely unmoored from reality. Like, he just talks and talks and talks, and none of it means anything. None of it makes sense. There is nothing about the performance that's substantial or concrete or anything. And like, especially as I've noted, it feels like by the end we're almost supposed to be rooting for the guy, or like, how can you have any connection to the characters that you're watching if they're operating at a completely different sphere of reality? And not in the sense of like A Beautiful Mind where, oh, Russell Crowe is insane, but we feel sorry for him. It's just, I genuinely do not know what I'm supposed to feel about the Eddie character. And if I'm not feeling anything, the 90 minutes of watching him talk is just irritating. I do not care. I want him to go away.
See, I like Penn's work here, but it's also a case where you're either on board with my view of what the film is actually doing or you're not. And if you're not on board with what my view of the film is doing, yeah, this will be a performance that absolutely drives you up the wall, and I completely understand that.
I think it's also because it feels very much like a 1970s sort of hey man, I'm writing a script based on how life really is kind of lines he has to deliver. Like, and it's full of that, like, so what can you do? Can you type 170 words per minute? Can you sew? Can you dance? What do you do? And it's like, just that rapidly for an hour and a half. I do not care.
Yeah.
I do not enjoy this.
I can understand that. Yeah. And again, it'll really depend upon what you think of what the film's doing overall. One thing I can 100% agree with you is probably one of my first major pit for this one. Okay, and again, it's also a scene that actually ties into my thesis that we can't actually take this film at face value, but let's talk about the haircut sequence, because, like, literally, if there's any moment in this film that tells you right off the bat, we are not in reality at all at this point, it's Eddie getting out of the institution, and apparently the first thing he does is just wander down the streets and into a full-blown hair salon. When my initial thought was, when he wanders into the scene, it's like, oh, this is what's replaced the bar. He's going to wander in there and discover it's no longer there. No, no, he went in there on purpose. And we have, like, despite having, as he admits, not much money, the hairstylist decides that, yes, I am going to take this on. Like, this is, oh, what was, what's his name's character from, Bronson Pinchot from Beverly Hills Cop. Like, it feels like we are, like, this is, like, the slightly toned down version of that as a hairdresser in this instance here. And, yeah, Eddie's gonna be put through this complete makeover where he suddenly gets this sort of long, blonde hair that's beautifully cut and everything else, for the punchline of Eddie eventually cutting some of the hair himself in a way that he likes it, to which I do love the hairdresser response of, it's hideous. But then he's just like, okay. But again, like, this scene just doesn't happen, folks, okay? Like, this, there is no, supports my...
Well, it's the pretty woman scene, except if at the end, or the heart condition scene.
Yeah.
If at the end, Bob Hoskins is like, yeah, that's a really nice suit, but, and then he just cuts the pocket off of it. You know, it's like, it feels like, again, it's a gag scene, and you know exactly where the gag is going, and it still takes about 5 minutes of screen time to get there.
Yeah, and that's the thing where it's like, this, again, the scene supports my thesis, but it's also a scene that shouldn't be in the movie, because it's just, it doesn't fit, it doesn't work, and, I mean, there were easier ways to give Sean Penn a haircut and a dye job in this movie than having this be the way.
But would you still have that thesis if this scene was not in the movie?
I think so, mainly based on a lot of other small choices and details, including John Travolta's performance late in the movie. But, like I said, we're not going to relitigate that right now in this instance. What is your second pit for this one? Because I know you've got one.
To think of specifics, I would honestly say the script by John Cassavetes, because, again, like, that's not to say that he didn't make good films, but it kind of feels like appealing to authority here, where, and maybe, like, as I understand, Nick did rework some elements of the original script, but I believe it is solely credited to John Cassavetes. I don't know if it was a case of not wanting to tinker too much, not wanting to modernize too much, but Cassavetes, the senior, in many ways, is product of a bygone era, product of a different time in Hollywood, a different way of working in Hollywood, a different time in dynamics between men and women. And again, it's the difference between going back and watching one of his films, knowing that, hey, this came out in 1967, and sort of taking it for what it is versus transplanting that into the present. And it's not just, like, the cultural politics of this film. It's just, if you took like Coppola's The Conversation, one of my favorite movies, if you took the same script and you made that today, it just wouldn't work, because so much of that film works due to the unity between the film's style, sort of just the overall holistic context the film is produced in, and the script is a part of that. And the problem is, you're ripping that script out of its context and then shunting that into the 1990s sort of suave Miramax style, And it just does not work.
And yeah, like I said, and certainly the script is not perfect. I think it's safe to say that ultimately I enjoyed the end results more than you, but it's not a perfect script. And yeah, there are flaws unquestionably there with it. For me, last but not least, my final major pit. You built a marketing campaign around the song Semi-Charmed Kind of Life, and you didn't use it once in the actual finished movie here, folks. Okay. That is...
You think that's a bad thing?
Like I said, look, this is like when they, you know, they use Song 2 by Blur for the advertising for Starship Troopers, and then you watch the movie and realize it never appears in the film. Granted, Starship Troopers, a much better film at the end of the day, and Basil Poledorius' score to that thing is freaking amazing, but you still kept going in there thinking, it's like, yeah, what are they going to queue up, you know, Song 2 or Blur by... or I can't remember whether Blur is the band or Song 2 is the band in this instance, but...
David, did you just ask if Blur was the band or if Song 2 was the band?
It was the 90s. Literally, these are not impossible distinctions to be have here in this instance.
That's true. So, I remember Filter coming out with an album called Title of Record.
Yeah, exactly. So, point being here that, I mean, come on. Even during the end credits, you know, it wouldn't have been a bad thing. I mean, yeah, I get why you went with DeLovely during this thing, with Tito Lavera plays or sings Quite Lovely. And yeah, I get Bjork's cover of Oh So Quiet there at the start there as well. Another thing, which, by the way, go
Is
back.
Is that a cover?
It's a cover.
Is it?
Yeah, it's a cover. That was, I'm trying to remember who sang the original version. I gotta go look this up now.
Oh my god, we can't agree on anything this episode. Do your own research at home, listeners. In the meantime, we're gonna salvage our friendship, though, by agreeing that choices were made when it came to this movie, and your mileage will certainly vary. But I know there's one thing we definitely can agree on, and that's that it is time for David to tell us where we're going to be going to next episode and how we're going to get there.
Well, the costume design on the film, which we never discussed, is by Beatrix Aurora Pastor, who we've previously covered on Drugstore Cowboy and Psycho 1998. We're going to be following her to about 8 years later, to 2005, to take a look at a film that I don't know how many people remember in this instance, but that is Karen Kasuma's adaptation of Aeon Flux, starring...
Aeon Flux, Aeon. Dave, you're betraying your nerd cred. I haven't seen the film. I had a phase a couple of years ago where I got super into Aeon Flux, so
yeah,
it's going to be interesting. All I know about the movie is enough to know that I haven't watched it, because I kind of knew what I was in for. But as we've often said, though, bad movies make for the best episodes.
Indeed. And we are definitely, definitely going to be looking at that one. And I believe we will have a special guest joining us for that one. So stay tuned for that one, folks. And it's Betty Hutton who sang It's Oh So Quiet originally.
All right. Apologies to the estate of one Elizabeth Hutton.
There we go. But on that note, yes, so let's just say you are on Team Andrew. Where can you go boast for your individual in this instance?
You can let me know on Twitter at FilmStripper, or use as many characters as you'd like by emailing our show at filmstripspodcast@gmail.com. Kevin from Seattle, the answer is 14. Dave, what about you? Where can people join your incorrect yet clearly thoughtful camp?
Team Irony can be found at 24 Panels on Twitter there. Always happy to have a civil conversation. Although, from what I'm seeing here, maybe this isn't the film to do that with.
I know. We're all mixed up. It's like that breakfast and... thing that Frasier sang about, I don't know, it's late and I need to eat something. In the meantime, though, if you want to help us eat something, stars, feel free
wow.
to rate and review us on iTunes. Yes, 5-star reviews help move us up the feature chart, and one day we'll monetize and be able to afford groceries. It's also a place where you can leave some long-form feedback and let us know what works for you, what doesn't. Because as we get perilously closer to the 200 episode mark, all Dave and I have wanted to do is one simple thing, and that's bring you a show that you want to listen to.
I'm now just imagining, like, is this what actually goes on in the Super Mario Brothers games? Are they eating the stars when they get them? Like,
that's what happens in Mario Galaxy.
Okay.
You get the little star bits, and then you shoot them into the thing, and then after, like, 100, it's like, boom, I just unlocked a new level. And then all of a sudden, the star's new husband comes out and says, you're not going to that new level. We got a level together. And then the star, like, tackles it and is like, it's not Galax him. It's not Galaxy. It's degalified.
And on that note, Andrew...
Mamma mia, two episodes in a row talking about Super Mario.
Yeah, Andrew, do you have any parting words you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Yes, David, I do. Remember, everyone, adventure may scare you, but monotony will kill you.
Baby, I hear the blues a-calling tossed salad and scrambled eggs. Bye, folks.
Mamma mia. Thank you.